Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. Scott Spears coming at you here on a Thursday morning, May the 21st, 2026, 17 minutes past the hour, and we are glad to be with you this morning. We've got a big program in store, but I want to greet you with the news this morning, if you have not already heard, that a regular guest on this program, many-time guest on this program, legendary, iconic representative, Congressman Barney Frank, died on Tuesday evening. We found out yesterday morning, at the age of 86. He had been in hospice care. A matter of fact, he had appeared on this program on May the 8th, which was just 11 days before his passing. Now, we've got somebody joining us in the first hour to remember Representative Frank and go through some current events of the day. And because tonight is Stephen Colbert's last show after 11 years and really ending a 33 run of late night programming on CBS that began with David Letterman in 1993, we have something very special planned at the end of this program today. So, it's a big hour. You're not going to want to miss it. And before I introduce our first guest, I want to go back to 11 days ago. Barney Frank was the guest on the program. He was in hospice care, and I opened up the program by asking how Representative Frank was, and this is what he said on May the 8th. Representative Frank, we all heard around here at the station that you had entered hospice care a couple weeks ago, and of course saddened to learn that. What can you tell us? What happened, and why have you entered hospice care?
Well, I inherited from my father a bad heart. He was otherwise a great parent. He died in 1960 at the age of 53 of the bad heart because there were no treatments in those days. In the interim, you know, one reason medicine is so much more expensive today is that we are buying a type of medical care that wasn't previously available. So with all that care and with other advantages, I've obviously lived long beyond the 53, but I never thought I would reach 90. I mean, I was told I had a weak heart. Frankly, it's less than organ than I thought, but it has finally just given out. I mean, I'm not, there's no great stroke that happened. It is just that my heart has finally worn out and sort of running to empty.
You know, Representative Frank, when people hear news like that the end is either imminent or near, it's a very scary time for people. How have you felt emotionally during this?
Well, better than I thought I would for a couple of reasons. First of all, I have a husband who has just been extraordinary. You know, obviously I've loved him and he's taken care of me and mutually, but he has put himself through hoops, taking care of me and making my life physically so much easier. Beyond that, my motivating goal in politics was to try to use public efforts to improve the quality of people's lives. But over the last 15 years, the obstacle to that emerged, exemplified by Donald Trump, which was this distrust of democracy, this angry, xenophobic populism, and trying to defeat that and reestablish support for liberal democracy has been my number one goal. And I felt frustrated at times by not being able to make more progress. And ironically, the best thing that ever happened to those efforts was this diagnosis, because I've been telling people on the left in my party why I think we should be more responsible, why they should withdraw from some of the extreme positions they've taken. And people were suspicious of that because, oh, well, he's just a secret conservative or he's just planning for the future to raise more money. Well, I'm clearly not planning for any political future. And over my career, I was on the left. I voted against the Iraq War. I voted against NAFTA. So I can't be accused of urging people on the left to be more responsible politically on the grounds that I'm trying to curry favor. So as a result, frankly, this is an example, I'm getting a chance to make the point that is so important to me. And in a way I hadn't expected, that's kind of an offset. Yeah, I'm dying a little earlier than I had expected to, but that's become the occasion, frankly, for making progress on an important issue more than I thought I would.
Representative Barney Frank, the late Representative Barney Frank, on this program on May the 8th. Joining us and welcoming, we're so glad to welcome to these microphones one of my favorite people, also a regular guest to this program, to help us sort out so many things, including this and anything else that might come up this morning. Somebody who knew Representative Frank very well, a man who has more than a half century experience in the news business, my good friend, a good contributor, a good newsman, a great newsman, Sam Donaldson. Sam, how are you?
Well, I'm fine, Scott. I'm joining you. I'm glad to be there. You know, everybody who was a reporter in Washington during those years, and Frank was in Congress for 16 terms, knew him. I was down in the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue covering the president, and he was up in Capitol Hill. But we all understood who he was. He did a lot of things for reform of the financial system, for instance, banking, and the acts that control our economy. But I guess the biggest contribution he made was when he came out as a gay man. And that was during a period when it was difficult to do that.
You know, Sam, is that his legacy? A lot of legislation he will be known for, but 1987, he becomes the first openly gay congressman, not to be outed by anybody. He did it on his own. Is that ultimately his legacy, being a first?
Well, I think it's twofold. He did a lot, as I say, in the economic area that helped the country, helped people here. But by coming out, he did a lot for the LGBTQ community. And there's a story going around, which I haven't been able to pin down, really, that he went to Tip O'Neill, the great Speaker of the House, and said, "Tip, I'm going to come out." And Tip said, "Now, Barney, your mother's still alive. Wait until, you can do it after she's gone." Well, he did it in 1987, and she lived on for many, many years, so I'm not sure that story is correct. But for whatever reason, he came out and became a champion. Here he was, a very powerful member of the Congress, someone who controlled a lot of the legislation that applies to all of us, and he's a gay man, and he says it. And later he marries a male partner, and he made many contributions toward the acceptance during a period when it was occurring that many people were coming out, and I think he was the leader of that.
Sam, just to give it some context from somebody who was there, how big a deal and how much of a taboo in 1987 was it to be an openly gay congressman?
Well, he was the first one, as far as the records that I read. He was the first one to do that. And being a powerful congressman, being someone respected, everybody liked him. I mean, he got humor. And he was tough in the committee to grill people. Remember, he did a good job. And being a man who did a good job and saying, "Hey, I'm gay," was very significant. For instance, there was an act that had been in the books for some time calling gay people national security risks for fear that our enemies would get hold of their fact that they were gay, that they were in the closet, and blackmail them. Well, he campaigned against them, and he said, against that, and he said, "Well, if you're going to say that we're all gay risks, I'm going to publish a list of people that I know who are in Congress who are gay, and let's talk about that." Well, immediately the push to abolish that law became very strong, and President Clinton did sign it and abolish it. So there's one of his acts that helped everybody who was also coming out of the closet.
You know, Sam, what was always interesting to me about him is that he commanded an audience. When he wrote books, they sold very well. When he was on television, the cameras went to him. People, if he would come out of a meeting, a session, people rushed to him to get a quote. Not many people have that anymore. What did he have that allowed him to have that kind of stature?
Well, one of the things that you now see in public life almost everywhere is he had a personality. He was a unique individual. He was someone who was not boring. He was someone that you followed and looked to. And many Americans today look to people that perhaps I think they shouldn't. But one of the reasons they do is the president, President Trump, is not boring. President Trump does things that are unique, exciting, and whether they're for the good of the country is something we're all discussing at the moment. So that's something that Barney Frank had. He was somebody who was humorous. He liked to joke with reporters. He liked us. Now, when I say he liked us, I'm not saying he liked me individually, but he didn't treat reporters as someone who would come to him and say, this question, Mr. Chairman, what do you have to say about that? It might be a little uncomfortable, and treat them as if they're an enemy. He'd say, well, let's sit down and talk about this. He'd tell the story and all, and you'd leave feeling very good with a notebook full of quotes.
You know something, there's another clip I want to play here. It's a shorter clip from that interview on May the 8th. It's hard for me to believe that that was just 11 days ago because he sounded so vibrant, the same. He sounded, you know, completely with it, which I think he was. But one thing during that interview I asked him as he was getting ready to depart this earth was, what is the message he wanted to leave for the Democrats who might be listening to that program or that particular interview? And here's what Barney Frank had to say on May the 8th on this program. Representative Frank, if there are Democrats out there listening right now, what is the number one most important thing they need to know from Barney Frank as he gets ready to depart this world?
That if liberals, mainstream Democrats, continue to support economic fairness, which we hadn't for a long time, and advocate social and cultural change that meets real needs and fills real gaps in society, but does not reach the point of alienating people and does not take toxic positions and insist that everybody endorse them, that we can defeat populism. That is, I think we're at a cusp here. And if we stop doing the wrong things and keep doing the right thing, we can defeat this, especially because Donald Trump is imploding. And I think it's very clear. You know, we had first underestimated Trump, then we overestimated him, and now we're back to an accurate estimate, which is, frankly, the man's a fool. He's not very bright, and he is so dominated by his ego that he acts in ways that are counterproductive. Excuse me.
No.
But what happened was, that's what we thought of him 20 years ago. Go back, people didn't take him seriously. And then he runs for president and shocks everybody by winning, at which point people said, oh my God, this guy is more than we thought. He's not a fool, he's a political genius. And he wins power by exploiting this ability he has to take advantage of people's anger. But having won power, it turns out, no, we were right in the first place. He is kind of a fool. He doesn't know very much. He has one power. He's what's called an idiot savant. He's idiotic about everything except one thing. That one thing is the ability to soak resentment and benefit from that, and he wins the presidency based on that. But having won the presidency, you look at him today, and I think he's floundering. So put all that together, and it seems to me to be a moment when we can win a historic victory, and that's the most important thing.
The late Representative Barney Frank, 11 days ago. Sam, what's your assessment of that?
Well, I know also he said toward the end of his life that he's a liberal. Of course he is. in the normal ways you would look at, in at least the old ways, of liberals versus conservatives. But he thought the Democratic Party was moving too far to the left, too fast to the left. He understood that to win elections, you had to have help from the center. He also understood that the people who get things done are the ones who say, I want utopia today, and I'll have utopia today. You're not going to have it. Utopia comes as it comes, step by step. So Bunny Frank was someone who wanted to stay to the left, obviously, but not too far to the left, and he cautioned the party against it.
Sam, if someone were to have met Barney Frank in Washington during his tenure, what kind of guy was he, aside from being this great representative? What kind of man was he?
Well, I tried to say it in a sense. You like to be with him. He was the kind of guy that was fun to be with, who treated you decently, as long as you treated him decently, interesting stories, who laughed a lot when he wasn't grilling people before his committee that needed to be grilled hard. It's, I mean, you all know them. Your listeners know people they like to be with. And say, well, why? Well, because he's a great guy, a great gal. Well, why? I don't know. It's just that they suit me. He suited us, okay?
Well, and Sam, something to me that was very interesting, here was a man who was in hospice, we were all aware of that, he's still doing interviews, he's still talking about current events, that's what he wants to talk about, it was still on his mind right up till the very end.
That's true, well, people do that. Art Buchwald, the great columnist, entered hospice. A year later, he died. During that year, he wrote his last book. So, the fact that people think, well, that means 3 weeks or, you know, a month and a half or something. Not necessarily. Each case is individual. And in Barney's case, he had a great life. And listening to him with you showed that he was still, yes, as you say, on his game. And then he died. And it comes to all of us. The life cycle can't be repealed. So it comes. And I think to Barney, he died very well.
I think you're absolutely right. Sam, one more bit on this. I want to ask you how you're going to remember him and how history should remember Barney Frank. But I asked Representative Frank that question when he was on this program on May the 8th, and this is what Representative Barney Frank had to say. Representative Frank, obviously we started the interview out by saying the first openly gay congressman, 1987. People are always going to remember that. You're a trailblazer. What do you hope people most remember you for?
Well, I will tell you this. I hope people will remember that I'm smart enough not to answer that question. Because there's no good way to answer. It's like being asked, who do you like better, your mother or your father?
And there's that attitude that I think people like being around. Sam, how's he going to be remembered?
Well, I remember him as one of those members of Congress who were the people that I knew for so many years, who tried to get things done. Different views, different ideas of how this problem could be solved for the country and the other problem, but doing it with education and doing it as an individual who was not someone ironclad tied to, as President Trump has such a number of
Nope. Sam, are you still there?
I'm still there.
Yeah, there we go.
Well, I can't repeat all that, but I'll remember him kindly, okay?
Yeah, absolutely. Sam, turning to some current events here, Representative Massey, Senator Cassidy lose their primaries against Donald Trump-backed candidates. Is this a good sign for President Trump or a bad sign heading into the fall? Now both men seem to oppose him all of a sudden on a lot of things they didn't oppose him on before.
Well, it's a good sign for President Trump in the sense that he still has an ironclad grip on what was the old Republican Party but no longer exists. You saw that in, what, the elections this week. And you in Ohio have seen it just recently. But does that mean that that's a sure thing that he's got a Trump win in November to keep both the houses of Congress? Absolutely not, because you see his public opinion polls are going down, down, down. 37%, which is low for any presidency, his first or his second. And look at all the problems he has to solve between now and then to help his party win. He's got to do something about Iran. And he can't figure out what to do. He wants to say it was a victory. But Iran is not playing ball with that idea. The Straits of Hormuz is still closed. The oil prices are still high and may go higher. And he's got to solve that. And then, of course, he's got to explain what's happened with trying to get $1.8 billion of public funds into the hands of people who've been convicted of their part on January 6th of 2 years ago. And he of course, has pardoned them all. And now they're eligible to get taxpayer money. This is atrocious. Hey, line up the truck at the back of the Treasury and just fill it up, Mr. President. And there's a little subject for him in this, too. So that's the thing now that he's got to try to convince the public is just peachy clean, the right thing to do. And I don't think he's going to be able to do that.
Well, and I certainly think that's the big story. And for people who haven't been following, I'm going to read a little bit of this. The Trump administration's newly announced $1.776 billion fund to compensate people who claim that the government weaponized the legal system against them has attorneys and communications professionals scrambling to position their clients for a handout, CBS News has learned. Legal groups and public relations offices in Washington, D.C. and New York City have been abuzz ever since the Justice Department's announcement on Monday of the extraordinary anti-weaponization fund. It was rolled out as part of the Justice Department's settlement of a $10 billion lawsuit against President Trump, or with President Trump, I should say, that President Trump had filed earlier this year against the IRS over the leak of his tax returns. Anyone targeted by the Department of Justice will want to submit, which is many of our clients, said a publicist who represented Sean Diddy Combs, convicted criminal, one of the more than 1,500 Capitol riot defendants pardoned by Mr. Trump upon his return to the White House. Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche, who previously worked as a criminal defense lawyer for Mr. Trump, signed a memo this week that said the Treasury Department will move the money into the fund within 60 days. The memo said a commission of five members appointed by the Attorney General will oversee the fund, which will last until December 2028. And by the way, also going along with this, any member of the Trump family and President Trump himself are now immune from audits and any audits in the past or the future of any taxes that he may or may not have paid. So that's the deal. Sam, you talked about it a little bit there. Unprecedented. How can this go over well with the country, and why do this at this point?
Well, at the moment, let's see, why did you do it? He thinks he can do anything. We are very near a point where, and I hope the courts will eventually, and the Supreme Court has to be in on this, stop him. But he's very near the idea that he can do anything he wants. And what he wanted to do was say that January 6th thing was patriots, not thugs who attacked our Capitol. Now, all of you have seen the videotape. It does not lie. They broke in. The Capitol of the United States was broken in by thugs because they were told by the president that they have to stop the certification of Joe Biden as president of the United States. And they roamed the corridors looking for people like the Speaker of the House, people in the Senate, looking to do them harm, looking for the vice president to harm him, clearly, to make him do what the president wanted. All right. Many of them were convicted. They start serving prison sentence. Now President Trump wins the election and comes back again. One of his first acts is to pardon them all, every one of them. And now he comes forward and he says, I sued the Treasury because my IRS stuff was, I sued the IRS because my files were leaked for $10 billion, but I'll settle. I'll be a nice guy and settle the government that I head, and however there be conditions, myself, my family, cannot be audited for anything the Treasury says or the IRS says I've done in the past. Not a thing. And there was an estimate of about $100 million he might owe for past problems with his taxes. Well, it doesn't matter. Now, secondly, he sets up a fund. Actually, it's the Justice Department that sets up the fund based on one act in the Treasury about 200 years ago and says, we will compensate people who we, meaning Biden's Justice Department, criminalized by having the court, the jury of the peers, convicting them. We will compensate these poor people that have now been pardoned for having been criminalized by the Biden Justice Department by $1.8 billion. Just sign up, folks. And we won't be able to tell you exactly who they are. These things are. We won't know who's getting the money. And ladies and gentlemen, I don't care at the moment which side of this great divide in our country you're on. If you think that's the right thing to do, excuse me, you shouldn't be listening to me in this program now.
You know, Sam, somebody has said to me, actually several people have said to me, you know, Trump was convicted of several crimes before he went back to the White House. A lot of those crimes were just pushed to the side because you can't indict a sitting president. And he seemingly got out of that. And a lot of people at that time said the reason he was running for president for a second term was so he didn't end up in prison, so he didn't end up in jail. He's got 2 years left on his term. If the Democrats do come in and possibly now win the Senate and win the House in the fall, because of things like this, is there any chance there aren't calls for impeachment? Is there any chance that when this man's out of office, which I assume that will come one day, that he would not be prosecuted for some of the things he's done now? Or does it fall under the Supreme Court ruling of a president can do anything?
Well, actually, the Supreme Court ruling, a lot of people use those words, can do anything. It didn't say he could do anything. It said that in his official capacity as president, he cannot be sued, and that includes criminal indictment, for things that he's done, even if they were mistakes. Even if he said to someone, I want you to do this, I want you to invade Iran. Okay, that's an official act in his capacity. He has, he claims, the right to do that, even without Congress, which is a right that many people believe he doesn't have. But he's not excused from a criminal act if later on it can be proved that he, as president, committed a criminal act, like Richard Nixon. I mean, the felony there for obstruction of justice. He can be tried. He can be taken to court. He can be judged by a jury of his peers, and if found guilty, he can be jailed.
Well, and at this point, I mean, you've interviewed Trump. Does he just want to create more problems for himself down the road? Or does he not plan to leave this office, as so many people have said?
Well, he talked yesterday about the possibility of a third term. Now, when Trump talks, meaning on his social gadget, he says things that are ridiculous, and people know that now. One day he says, it's almost a deal with Iran. I think we've got it. The next day, I'll bomb them back to the Stone Age. He says things on the spur of the moment that he doesn't think through, and he doesn't really mean the next moment. So I can't really tell you what's in his mind and where he's come from. I just know that his father raised him, and Roy Cohn, the great lawyer for the Army McCarthy hearing. And I know he had a sister and a brother. The brother died of alcoholism at age 41. And the sister, who the father clearly didn't care about, became a federal judge. She's retired and now died last year. But she was well respected as federal judges and their decisions. And we know people personally who knew her on the Third Circuit and said she was just fine. So Donald Trump was raised to be who he is, and to ask me, a non-psychologist, we're all, you know, armchair psychologists, what makes him do what he does? I can't find it.
Do you think if the Democrats win in the fall that they can come in next year? And, I mean, any number of things in the last 2 years certainly would be considered impeachable offenses for any other president. Can they come in and impeach him? Or are they going to say, oh, you Democrats are just doing that for the third time, you just want the guy out?
Well, if it became true that they controlled both houses of Congress, they could start an impeachment process in the House of Representatives, and they could probably get a vote to send it to the Senate. It all depends on the Senate. I'll never forget the day the Senate excused Donald J. Trump from his impeachment over there. And the same day, the majority leader of the United States Senate, a Republican, gave a fiery speech on the floor, read it in the Congressional Record, which is as much an indictment of Trump and an anti-Trump speech as you'll ever read. Mitch McConnell. So why did he vote to acquit Trump? Well, because Trump had the Republicans in the Senate in an iron grip for some reason. They're afraid that they won't be reelected. They're afraid of doing something that opposes him. Would that happen again? Well, it would depend on the Senate. If an impeachment vote came over from the House, they'd better count noses beforehand, or else he would be accused once more.
You know something, Sam. A lot of people have said a lot of things about President Trump. This is who he is. And if you look at the tapes, I mean, it pretty well is who he has been for the most part for the past half century. And people have said he's losing his cognitive ability. None of us are doctors, I guess. Maybe, maybe not. But what about the people like J.D. Vance? What about the people like Marco Rubio? What about that group of people who consider themselves politicians? I think they consider themselves good people. I think they consider themselves people who want a career after Donald Trump is no longer there. Going along with things like this $1.8 billion fund to compensate January 6th rioters, what do they do when he's gone?
Well, they're vying right now for the opportunity to be the nominee next time for the presidency. But they're caught between what they see as this iron grip by a great number of voters in this country, our fellow Americans. And if they defy them, they won't be the one. On the other hand, they also see the rising public disapproval of President Trump. Does he lose? Almost 3 or 4 Republicans already, a couple of them because he beat them or had someone else beat them. And if the Republicans in the Senate particularly begin to move away from him, then Rubio and Vance have to reconsider their own as they move toward the election year 2 years away. So that's where they are, and they can't predict any more than I can what's going to happen between now and then.
It's an interesting time for this reason, Sam. We're less than 6 months away from the elections, just about 6 months away from the elections in November. Now, Trump clearly does not want to lose power. He does not want to lose the House. He does not want to lose the Senate. He certainly doesn't want to lose both of them. They're trying to do things with redistricting. They're trying to get the Supreme Court involved with this and haven't gotten the Supreme Court involved with this. But yet, things like $5 gas that impact everybody, $5 a gallon gas, you know, that's just seemingly there and can't do anything about it. It seems
he's got to solve it. If he wants public opinion to come back, if he wants gas prices to go down in his favor, he has got to stop this business with Iran. Because Iran clearly can outdo him in the short term. Maybe for 4 months, our CIA and our intelligence community suggest, before Iran just goes under. You don't have to bomb them. Their people collapse. They don't have the ability to have food and shelter. But in those 4 months, Iran stays clear, and they stay blocking the Hormuz Strait. So Trump must settle it. But to settle it, he can't fool all of the American people all of the time. He's got to come away with an agreement that makes it clear that Iran is not going to ever have an atomic weapon. But Iran, of course, is saying, we'll come to the table, we'll make an agreement, we'll open the strait, but we're not going to discuss that now. We'll kick that down the road. And he realizes that won't work. I'm not sure what I would advise him if I were his principal advisor. I'd say, talk it up, using the common language today. Say you've won. Try to insist that people will believe that you've won. Make the deal to kick it down the road and open the Hormuz Strait and get the oil prices down, gasoline prices down. Because it'll take 2 or 3 months if it happened tomorrow. But he's got to do it. And if he tries to do it by bombing alone and say, well, I'll go back to the business where I said, if they don't do what I say, I will destroy their civilization. If he tries that, the world won't allow that. He can't get away with that. And by the way, for the first time, apparently publicly, we see that he and the Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel had a little spat yesterday, apparently, in which Prime Minister Netanyahu railed against the PACE pact, railed against ending the war. And Trump said, well, we think we have to do it. And by the way, he said, the Israeli leader will do whatever I want him to do, close quote. I'm sure that the Prime Minister Netanyahu liked that.
Speaking of the war in Iran and inflation, inflation's at a three-year high in the United States, and Trump last week during an impromptu press conference as he was getting ready to, I think he was getting on the jet at that point, the helicopter, he was asked about Americans and their finances, and the quote was, I don't think about Americans' finances.
Well, it was a quote, but you didn't hear all the quote. For some reason, I've got to say, that's one time that his language was either misunderstood or taken wrongly. He said, as long as I'm trying to make the deal and we win in Iran, I don't care about American finances over that. You see the difference?
There is a difference, right. So why do you think that the media in general twisted that a little bit?
Well, I'd like to think it was a mistake. Go back and look at the transcript. I think I've got it right in the exact language, or so close to it. But the point was, he wasn't saying, I don't care American finances. He was saying in the context of working hard to get the right deal with Iran, that's not the principal point.
Right. And you know, and I think that in general is creating an even greater distrust with the media because things like that do happen and that becomes a widespread story. And then he goes, well, look, they're doing it to me again.
Well, reporters have to be very careful. And I think most of them that I admire and I watch or listen to or read try to be very careful in handling the president, his statements and what he does, not to exaggerate his terrible faults. You don't have to. You just have to say what he does. And one half the country, I think just a little more now because of his dropping approval ratings, understand. But we don't fight fire by playing wrong.
Yep.
We go into the dark alley these days politically with a big knife because we have the other side with a big knife there. But we don't somehow give the banana peel on the floor, too. Let's play it straight. Let's play it fair.
Well, and also this week, I think something that was quite interesting was Mark Cuban joined President Trump in a press conference for the rollout of Trump RX, and he was heavily criticized on a lot of programs, a lot of media, for even being there, and Mark Cuban said, this has been one of my lifelong projects, is to get health care down. It seems like this will do that, prescription drug costs down, but he's criticized royally in a lot of media for even being there.
Well, I know Cuban. not well, but I think he's a good guy. He's one of the billionaires, and I know several billionaires that I wouldn't say that about. But if he does believe that Trump can help him out and will help him out, even though, remember this, one thing you can always count on, Donald J. Trump is there for himself. No one else matters at the end of the game. He wants to win, and he wants to come out with that big truck at the Treasury. So if Cuban thinks he can also...
We're going to do something fun here just in a second. But tonight is Stephen Colbert's last night on the air. After 11 years, he's been on the air. Some CBS will say that late night programming costs too much money. That's why they're doing away with the show. And others will say that a merger was not going to go through if Stephen Colbert was not taken off the air. He leaves as the number one late night television show. When he was fired, he was the number one late night television show. A lot of eyes going to be on that program tonight as he signs off. What do you think the legacy of Stephen Colbert is, Sam? And why do you think he was fired?
Well, he was fired, I think, my opinion, quite clearly, because he was interfering with the merger of two large corporations. And by doing that, he was interfering with something Trump wanted. Oh, Trump got him. Now, Kimmel's different. At the moment, he's still holding out. We'll see how that one comes out.
Now, what we're going to do here in celebration, in honor of the Stephen Colbert Show, is Sam has agreed to do something. It's called the Colbert Questionnaire. Now, if you watch the Colbert Show, this is a questionnaire of 15 questions that Stephen and his staff came up with, and they ask this of almost every guest on the program. A lot of famous people have taken it. Tom Hanks, President Obama took it, I believe, last week. Now, the reason this came about is in 2019, Keanu Reeves was guesting on The Late Show with Colbert, and Colbert asked him, "What do you think happens when we die?" After taking a beat, Keanu Reeves delivered a very thoughtful response. "I know that the ones who love us will miss us." The exchange went viral and got Colbert thinking about ways to regularly play with a more spontaneous line of questioning. And so came the Colbert Questionnaire. And today, Sam has agreed to take this. So we'll start with question number one here. This is the Colbert Questionnaire. Sam, what's the best sandwich?
Grilled cheese.
Grilled cheese. Number two, what's the best thing you own that you really should... What's one thing that you own that you really should throw out?
I have a 2010 pickup truck. Not only is it on its last leg, but it barely can move. I should throw it out.
What is the scariest animal?
Rattlesnake.
Mm. Apples or oranges?
Well, you know, apples is what everyone should say. An apple a day makes the doctor away, keeps the doctor away. But I say oranges.
Have you ever asked someone for their autograph?
Well, I've asked someone to write their name on legal documents and things like that as witnesses. But if you mean as a fan, "Oh, wow, this Hollywood star, I'd love to have the autograph," the answer is no.
What do you think happens when we die?
Well, there's no afterlife, as far as I'm concerned. Dust thou art, and dust is returneth to. So that's it.
Favorite action movie?
Shane.
Mm. Favorite smell?
A woman's perfume.
Any particular perfume?
Well, I haven't smelled a perfume on a woman that I thought, "Wow, that's terrible." They're all sweet. They're all nice. I mean, wow.
Least favorite smell?
Rotting flesh. In Vietnam once, when I was covering the war there, a helicopter came back from a place that had been overrun by the North Vietnamese, but then retaken by the South after several days. And I helped unload from two helicopters the remains of the South Vietnamese soldiers, and I've never smelled anything like that. I hope never to again.
Exercise, worth it?
Yes.
Flat or sparkling?
Flat.
Most used app on your phone?
The Google search engine.
You get one song to listen to for the rest of your life. What is it?
I get what? Well, five words to listen to or,
no,
to live?
You get one song to listen to for the rest of your life. What would it be?
Live comfortably, peacefully, and honorably.
What number am I thinking of?
I don't know.
It was number three. It was number three. And the final question, if you had to listen to a piece of music for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Tchaikovsky.
And that is the Colbert Questionnaire. And just repeat it one more time. Describe the rest of your life in five words.
Well, that's what I'm... If I describe what I believe and hope will be the rest of my life, five words are live comfortably, peacefully, and honorably.
That's not bad at all. That was the Colbert Questionnaire. Stephen Colbert signs off tonight, 11:35, the CBS Television Network. Sam, what's Colbert's legacy as a late-night host?
Well, we started out, you know, pretending to be a hard right guy, all on the right. That wasn't him at all. He finally found his real ability when he became who he was, the guy on the left. And he had the ability to charm us, to amuse us, but the way to me, the greatest night host was Johnny Carson. He had, for me and my generation, he had the touch. The later humorists are more snarky. They come right to it. They do something that makes you laugh, they hope, but also in the public arena, makes a commentary on what's going on in the world. So I like him. I like Kimmel. I like Colbert. But at my age, I'm not up to watch him. So they go without me. 92 is at 29.
And that's a good way to put a pin in it. It's been fun remembering Representative Barney Frank, covering a few current events and having some fun with the Colbert Questionnaire. Nobody who knows more, nobody who's better, and nobody who knows how to have a good time during a broadcast like the legendary Sam Donaldson. Sam, thank you so much, and stay well, and we'll talk again soon.
I hope so. Bye-bye.
Stay well. Bye-bye. Sam Donaldson, you can't beat that, taking the Colbert Questionnaire this morning, the last Stephen Colbert show tonight at 11:35 on CBS. We'll be back right after this. Don't go anywhere.
Guy offering remote and on-site technical support, network setup, and computer troubleshooting for homes and businesses.